It has been a very unusual week. I think most people that I know of have been experiencing enormous pressures on themselves, enormous pressures internally. And it seems that this experience of pressure has been pretty universal with everybody. I've been speaking about situations developing, unusual pressures that weren't there before, problems with people or seemingly problems with people. If you look in the world, you'll see there's enormous amounts of conflict. It doesn't have to be very large ones, but a lot of personal conflicts, a lot of conflicts about egos, a lot of conflicts about power, and a lot of conflicts about principles and ideals. You might even say that seemingly people are becoming clearer about themselves and therefore clearer about what they like and what they don't like, what they want and what they don't want. Now, that would sound very, shall we say, contradictory in a sense, that clarity would bring conflict. Now, that would make no sense. Yet, it does make sense when one has chosen to live in an illusory acceptance of affairs and wakes up and says, wait, something's wrong. Let's say you're sleeping in your bed and, you know, you have some feeling something's not perfect, but you don't worry about it, yet you're kind of complacent about it. But one day when you're cleaning, you look underneath and you see that the bedboards are cracked. And when you see that the bedboards are cracked, what happens is that all of a sudden it clarifies to you that something serious is wrong, and you have to do something about it immediately. You're no longer happy with the bed. Maybe you weren't happy with the bed before, but it was a vague unhappiness. It was like, okay, there's this annoyance, there's this problem. You kind of like just let it go. But when you look underneath and you see, this thing's broken. There's something seriously wrong here. You become clear as to an impending danger or a problem or a conflict, and immediately it changes the way you've been seeing things. Complacency or acceptance has been replaced by a feeling of need to do something, to correct something, to fix it, to change. Now, people, as you know, have this tendency to settle into complacency, to not make big changes, to rather go with whatever was there because it was secure. I'll give you an example. In Europe, we always had very small cars which had good gas mileage because gas was very expensive. Unless you were very rich, you could have a Mercedes and burn up gas. But in America, gas was cheaper, therefore everybody had very big engines that just simply drank gasoline like there was no lack of it anywhere. Now the prices are going insanely high, but nobody wants to really sell their big cars or change what they've got because they're very complacent. They just want it to be the way it is, and they want gas prices to go down instead of them having to adjust what kind of cars they have. And they didn't really want to see it as a problem until the prices got so high that they couldn't pay for it anymore. All of a sudden, they have to do something about it. There's also this agitation that comes from it. So when things are going the way we're accustomed to them going, we're not very inspired to make changes. But when there's something really broken, when there's something really serious, we become very encouraged to make a change, yet that brings some kind of agitation because we don't want to do it. So when we're forced to make a change, when we're forced into transformation, at that time only do we start to feel that agitation, when we start to feel the conflict, we start to look and find fault and blame in those forces which make us feel like that. So we therefore enter into a state of agitation, a state of conflict, a state of disturbance, where we just don't feel at all right. Yet it's a state born of awakening, of clarity, of realization of what is there. Now, isn't that interesting? Many times we've discussed that real transformation and real change only takes place when there is enormous conflict. And what is even more interesting is that conflict usually has to be something that comes from outside, because we, many of us, have been dealing with internal conflicts without being forced to make changes. As we've discussed, we have seen that often, many times, people enter into internal states of conflict, internal states of disturbance, where they cannot accept what is going on. They cannot understand what is going on. Yet, they allow themselves to live with that state. They allow themselves to deal with that state without being forced to deal with the situation. So they end up giving themselves some kind of disease or some kind of extreme mental problem. So those who don't deal with contradictions within themselves or conflicts within themselves naturally have disturbances that cause disease or cause mental illness. We've discussed that already. That we have discussed in many different conversations. We really understand that point, but that's not the point I'm making today. Because a lot of the times the people who do get themselves sick due to internal conflict or whatever, they don't change. They just accept the sickness as being unrelated, or they embrace the sickness as a means to exit, that we've also talked about. So that's not really the point of what I'm discussing today. Today I'm talking about external things, conflicts, disturbances, agitations that are outside of us, that are pushing themselves upon us in a way which, you know, really affect us. Kind of like when you have a shirt with a label in the back that's real itchy and scratchy and constantly, you know, you're going crazy scratching the back of your neck here because that label is just so awfully uncomfortable. And sometimes, you know, you just crash your car into a tree and the agitation is so completely obvious. Sometimes you understand familial conflicts. Those are the worst. When you have conflicts within your family or you have conflicts with people who you work with, these are very serious problems. You lose your money or you get fired from your job or something like that. I'm not saying the internal ones are not serious. They're just as serious. But I'm saying these external conflicts are very hard to forget about. And often these things force you to make a change. Now let's think about a very historical example, very global a kind of example in the Mahabharata. Now, think about the Pandavas. Maharaj Yudhisthira got into this gambling match. They lost everything. They went to the forest. They had a lot of mental disturbance. They had a lot of problems. But somehow or another, they accepted it and waited for their period of exile to end. And somehow or another, during this time, it was accepted. It was all right. They got through it. They accepted it. They dealt with it. They weren't happy inside. They were very disturbed inside. But they got through it. They waited patiently. Now, the point at which, when they came back from their exile, they found out they were not going to get their kingdom back, that went from the point of internal conflict to something externally being forced upon them. And that forced the change. That forced the change of practical reality in the political arrangement of the time. And then another change took place within Arjuna, who internally was faced with the conflict of having to take an external action which wasn't really according to his internal interests. And reconciling the two was the cause of the Bhagavad Gita being spoken. You can see throughout history. Look at World War II, another perfect example of complacency at work. The human desire to not get involved, to not make changes, to just let things be. The human feeling that don't change, just leave it the way it is, it'll be fine. When the Germans were marching through Europe, taking one place after another, annexing countries, and the British were trying to do diplomacy and getting signed papers and declaring peace in our time, it was complacency at work. And the Americans were thinking, it's far away, has nothing to do with us, Europeans are always fighting, why should we be involved? So everybody was complacent. Although this aggression against other countries was going on, people thought, well, it's not affecting me, nothing I have to do about it. But when there was an external forced change of circumstances, for example, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, the whole situation was forced to change. So therefore, I've entitled this lecture, A Practical Affair, because life is a practical affair. And practicality is based on the principle of management. Now, if you think about this series of lectures we've had, we've been talking about spiritual mysticism, and we've gotten this taste for the experience of spiritual mysticism, of connection, of utilizing that connection, utilizing that mystical energy we have for wonderful activities and experiences. We talked about the beliefs which lay at the very basis upon everything we do and which either give us power or take it away. We talked about being and doing. We talked about the being as the essence of what we are, and the doing is the manifestation of it. And today I'm talking about the doing itself, the practicalities surrounding all doing which affect our being, as we described last week. Now, for those who are engaged in the deepest levels of their beings, meaning that they're in contact with their being, their consciousness is experiencing the awareness of their being, peace is very important. Because when there's no peace, the being is agitated. That's what the definition of peace is. And that agitation usually demands some kind of action. A change is required to establish the peace that is needed, besides being the technical guy and taking care of everything else around here. We have to give a lecture too. Not so simple. But isn't that exactly what I was just talking about? Isn't that a perfect example of exactly what I was just talking about? Here I was, in this state of being, in this state of just expressing my being through this discussion. And then, all of a sudden, practicality just, boom, transferred the whole thing. So here, all this peace was there. All of a sudden, peace totally destroyed. Action had to take place. So, change. I had to stop speaking. I had to get up. I had to go take him. I had to find a scissor to cut the gauze pad, and that was the whole thing. And somehow fix this dog who insists on pulling out his stitches. So, I mean, isn't that a perfect example? That you can have this understanding of being, you can have this peace, you can be completely connected with the whole universe, but when practicality comes, it dominates our lives. And this practicality, this doing, usually conflicts with our deepest interests for spirituality or being. And this conflict causes action. Now, some people have different feelings. I mean, all people have different feelings. All people have different values. But sometimes we can see that very clearly compared to what another person couldn't. I've seen people who can live in a very sloppy way, a very dirty way, and not be concerned about it, not care about it at all. For whatever reason, they can live with it. Yet other people cannot have any peace when their whole environment is in chaos around them. I know that when I'm working during the day, I'm doing many different things. I'm engaged again and again in activities. I fill my office room here. I fill everything with papers and boxes and all kinds of stuff. It just becomes total chaos. But I know where every single piece of paper is. I know where everything belongs. It all makes perfect sense to me because I'm in the middle of the process of creation. But when I fall out of that process of creation, when I'm in a different mood and I look around me, I say, oh my God, it's total chaos, and I have to clean it all up. So we see that the being can tolerate certain situations at certain times. It depends on your mood. It depends on how the external affects the internal. But when it disturbs the being, action must take place because we have to make some adjustment so our being can live in peace. Because when our being is not in peace, our whole life becomes upside down. We can't live with it. It's a chaos which just disturbs us to the core. Now, there was a philosophy I remember quite some time ago, very famous. This person, he was Meir Baba. He was saying, don't worry, be happy. And he had a big smile on his face. And I always used to love his face. I used to think this was just such a pleasant person. Don't worry, be happy. What a great philosophy. And I was kind of floating around in this feeling of don't worry, be happy, and feeling very good about it for quite some time. And because I had no real external responsibilities, it was during my time in school, my university days, I had no external responsibilities. I really didn't have anything to worry about. Everything was kind of taken care of. And so, everything went on until the point at which there were things to worry about. And then, don't worry, be happy became a little bit more difficult. And then, I became more like, well, here's something to worry about. Let me just fix it so I don't have to worry and I can be happy. So, don't worry and be happy became solve the causes of worry so you can be happy, which was not the point of it. The point of don't worry, be happy is just stop worrying totally and just live life without having to be attached to all of these things and all of these problems. Just let it be and be happy. But to do that, you have to be completely detached from all material things. That means if you got in an accident, don't worry about it. It's just your body. Let it be. And you have usually no family. But if you did have a family and anything happened to them, just accept it. That's all. Don't worry about it. Or if you see other people being harmed, don't worry about it. Just be happy. Now, I don't know about you, but for me, that kind of philosophy is impossible. If I see other people being harmed, if I see animals being harmed, if I see situations becoming intolerable, well, I do worry about it because I feel I have to do something about it. I don't just feel that I should just simply be in this meditative state and let it go on the way it is. I feel I should interact with it and make a change. Now, I'm not saying that my idea is better than Meir Baba's idea or even that Meir Baba's idea has some problem with it. I'm simply saying that's just the way I see things. And a lot of people were very positively influenced by him, even me. I mean, there were positive things in this being idea that make being your whole life. There's very positive things to be said. But reality dictates that at times, doing is an essential part of the being, because the doing and the being are connected, even if one is the cause and the other is the effect. And here's a very interesting aspect of this world, if I may use those terms, this reality that we live in, that the doing aspect, the existence that we are in, creates, for better or for worse, a codependency between being and doing. That being becomes a practical affair. And because being is a practical affair, spirituality in general has always tended towards structures, tended towards discipline. That's why regulation became so important, this concept of regulating life, because it would take away worry that would create situations which would impinge upon being. So you eat this way, you sleep this way, you act this way, you do this in this way, you do that in that way. Give it all some structure. Don't worry about these things and just be happy, engaged in spiritual activity. So now you have the situation where, because being and doing are interrelated, they are an interactive affair. Regulate the doing because we consider it just an external affair, and concentrate on the being because the internal is more important. But because of the interactivity between being and doing, nobody's happy just being, so they have to be given regulated ways of spirituality. Not only regulate the material things like how you wash or when you wash or with what temperature water you wash, for example, the way in which the spirituality manifests, strictly structured in all ways. So you meditate like this, you chant like that, you read like this, you hear like that, you serve like this, you preach like that. All these things regulated, even down to the time it is done. Now, there was a reason for that. It's not like this is some kind of like dictatorial, mindless fascism. There's a reason for it. And that reason is a very serious attempt to deal with the interactivity between being and doing. It's not like the problems we're dealing with now in our evolution are unique. These are problems that have been there throughout historical time, and spiritual traditions, prophets, religious leaders, people in all over the world have been dealing with the exact same types of problems. Yet, if you consider it, when you try to structure the being, you destroy it. Let's go back to the nature of our being, the nature of our essence. The nature of our being is peace. The nature of our being is freedom, that the energy just flows out, the love flows out. It love flows in the complete union with the existence around us, the union with the divine, and the full feeling of knowing what is right, knowing how to exist without having to be dictated to. Now, for very good reasons, this being is being restricted in a structure for the sake of this being getting to the point where the being can be. So now you've got sadhana bhakti and raganuga bhakti. You've got the state of strict restriction to get to the state of freedom. And for those who have been in that state of sadhana, they start to pull their hair out. They say, oh my God, do I have to go back to that state of restriction in order to get to the state of just being what I know I am. So here I am coming from all of that, making a left turn, making a right turn, making a somersault, trying to bring everything to the point where it all makes sense again. Well, that's not so simple, yet it is historically something which takes place periodically. There is a nice spiritual idea, ideal. It goes on for some time. It develops. It expands. It gets corrupt. It gets exploited. It starts to harm people. Some reformer comes along, throws out the whole thing, changes it in a way to bring it back to its original, expand it a little, stretch it a little. That goes on for some time, gets corrupted and exploited, and you will get the picture. It's a cycle. So from the historical point of view, what we're doing is nothing unique. And in fact, all of the things that we talk about are not unique or fantastic revelations. They just happen to be interesting for us now. And similarly, people have dealt with the same situations, came to the same peace in their own particular way, relevant to their own particular state of evolution throughout history. So one can understand that what really counts, what is really important, is the transformation forward. That there's a stimulation, a catalyst for change that keeps us moving forward. And that catalyst is the continued interaction between being and doing. So we may be saying, I can't stand all of this agitation. I'm sick of it. You know, I'm fed up with all these problems. But actually, they are catalysts. So don't worry about them. Be happy. Don't worry means don't be totally disturbed to such a degree that you lose focus, lose the vision of what's actually going on. Let's talk about this catalyst. Let's talk about how this force is in action. Let's talk about how the being becomes disturbed into action in relationship to pain in a tooth. Let's say I have a pain in my tooth. My being is disturbed. I feel pain. Acceptance of the idea, don't worry, be happy, just accept everything, don't be attached, doesn't seem to be solving my problem. Now, I have two choices I can make. I can say, I'm not very advanced, I'm not very spiritual because I'm not detached from this pain, I'm not detached from this anxiety. Another way to deal with it would be to say, I accept I have this problem. I accept I have this pain. I accept the situation as a consequence of my previous activities. I accept, for example, I chewed on a rock. It was my fault somehow or another. Not really, but okay, it happened. Or I ate too much sugar or something like that. Okay, I accept it. Now I have to do something about it as best I can. So I make a dentist appointment. I get the thing fixed. I pay the dentist. All right, it's a loss of time, a loss of my part of my tooth, a loss of money. I accept that. Now there's a third thing I could have done, but I didn't think any sane person would consider it. But that would be that I have pain in my mouth, so I'm going to be really upset and really disturbed and angry, and I'm going to throw chairs through windows, and I'm going to break everything in the house. So here I see we find that formula which can reconcile being and doing, which incorporates detachment, which incorporates acceptance, which incorporates forgiveness, which incorporates all of these good qualities which a spiritualist naturally has. My being is disturbed by some external thing. I accept that the external thing exists, and I'm going to deal with it. I'm going to deal with it with detachment. I'm going to deal with it with acceptance. I'm not going to avoid my responsibility. And in this way, I will use this catalyst as a means to express my spirituality, my being. So the practicality of my life will become integrated into my spirituality. And there you see the seeds of the justification of the Varnashram system, of the arrangement of society into some managerial cohesive whole. Right now, at this period of time, we have a situation here which is different than at any other time in history due to the technological facilities at our disposal. Or the way that we live, the way that we have to make money, the way that we're forced to interact with each other is also unique in historical time. So the catalysts that cause us to change and transform are very different than the ones that were there previously. Therefore, the principles, the disciplines, the structures within which we, as individuals who have spiritual desires to evolve, may feel comfortable in, are very different than the ones that a person in the past would feel comfortable in. Yet, who can create a generalized set of instructions for modern man? It's very difficult. Therefore, it's much easier, from one point of view, to transplant some ancient culture into the modern time and then request everybody to accept that culture, because within that culture, all of these disciplines and rules make sense. But within the context of the reality within which we live, it does not make sense. And therefore, there's another kind of conflict between the being and the doing. Now there's a societal conflict. There's an economic conflict, the way in which money is made. There's a psychological conflict. There's an emotional conflict, which demands change, transformation. So from that point of view, our attempt to make sense of this, of the connection between being and doing, makes perfect sense. It is perfectly reasonable and rational. Therefore, what we are doing really is presenting the tools by which spirituality can be developed within the allowance of the individual taking the responsibility to structure his or her life in a practical way to balance the being and the doing. And I'm trying to do that by giving everyone an experience of the being, an experience of the being in such a real manner that they themselves become qualified to understand how to balance the two. In other words, the previously relevant methodology of structured, externally imposed structures as being the regulative means between being and doing are being replaced in what we are doing with the individual internally creating those structures as they are relevant to them. Now, this is much harder. I'll give you a little example to explain the situation. For example, in Sweden, the tax structure is very simple. Everybody pays the same tax. There are no deductions. There are no exceptions. You just get your bill and that's it. There's this percentage and that's all there is to it. In America, there are literally hundreds of thousands of laws and codes and exceptions and deductions and reductions and increases and situations. You need to have experts figure it out. It is so complicated. So Sweden's very easy. You don't need to know anything. You don't need to hire people. You don't need to worry about it. It's just the way it is. It's very simple. It's taken care of for you. In America, it's very complex. It requires personal initiative. It requires great education. It requires endeavor. But in Sweden, you pay a lot of tax. In America, you can pay much less tax when you do it right. In other words, the personal responsibility is much more difficult, but you can get much more out of it. When you surrender yourself to a already existing package deal, you're surrendering a lot of freedom. You're surrendering a lot of personal initiative, personal growth, for the sake of making it easy. And that in itself is a cause of stress, much more than you could imagine. Socialism has its own stresses, as all of you in Russia know. Hey, I ask all of you there in Russia, formally, you didn't have to think too much. Everything was regulated. No problem. Now you have to think so much, struggle so much. Would you rather go back? Or, as the famous song said, how are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Paris? After you've experienced what you can get from your personal endeavor, when you have personal responsibility, when you can experience the intensity of personal interaction, you don't want to go back into that situation. The child is taken care of. Everything is structured. The parents give them a place to eat, a place to sleep, something to eat, clothes to wear, tell them what to do. Everything's easy. Do the adults want to go back to that situation, however easy it was? No way. So combined with this practicality between the interaction of being and doing, between the interaction of managing life, there's another factor, which is the age of the person who's doing all of this. And just imagine some younger person comes up to you and says, wow, this being is great, this like experiences are great, but what do I do now? What should I do? And you have to answer them. Most of us who are watching these broadcasts, listening to these lectures, are older. Think about that. We've been there. We've done that. We're older. Taking personal responsibility is not a luxury for us. It's our right. It's our demand. So we'll be complacent in our understanding, our realization of how we're living with the spiritual actions we are undergoing. We'll be complacent with it. We'll be very happy with it. But then the transformation is demanded. The catalyst will come, and it comes in terms of these young people who come and say, well, what do we do? What should I do? What do you recommend? Or your children will just do strange things, and then you'll be in the situation of saying, well, you can't do that. And they'll say, why? And then you'll go, well, because of this and that. And then you'll realize all of the assumptions you have made in life, all of the discipline and regulation you've accepted in yourself. What if you go to the park with your kid and your kid goes by a hot dog? How do you deal with that? And you ask, you can't do that. Why? I want to try it. But that you can't do. Did you ever try a hot dog? Well, yeah, but that's different. Why? How do you deal with that? Be aware of all of these assumptions you've made in your life, all of the things you've picked up in your life, which you just accept as principles in your own life and live them because you're already evolved enough to do so. And that forces another kind of change, another kind of transformation, another kind of interaction between being and doing, because it's practical. We're living a practical life. But one thing I've understood, I'm not trying to say I've answered this question. I'm just bringing the question to our awareness. But one thing I've understood is as soon as you say, it is like this and it can be no other way, you've lost. Because now in your life and now in the life of everyone around us, being stuffed into a box is very difficult Because there are so many varieties of boxes to be stuffed into. Formerly, there were only a few boxes. So you got stuffed into them very easily because there weren't a big choice. And you could fit in this one, that one, the other one. It was okay. They were all right. Now, there's such a variety that I saw on TV yesterday, or was it the day before, a show which was so fascinating, I have to discuss it with you because it's directly addressing this point. Now, as you know, America has a president who is in a very particular conservative way, and his vice president is considered to be much worse in that regard by those who criticize him. The conservative Republicans have a very strong stance that homosexuality is not to be tolerated in certain circumstances. It's something unnatural, and that marriage between homosexuals is unnatural. And homosexuals cannot really be married because marriage means you can have children. And that's the point of marriage, to have children and raise them and, you know, be prosperous and multiply, as it says in the Bible. Now, one of the platforms of Republicans are that the government should not restrict too much. Because the Democrats, they always say there should be like more socialistic protection for everybody because people need it. And the Republicans say it should be more individually based. Yet Republicans will make statements such as meant to regulate society based on moral principles, based on even religious principles. So in the middle of all this, the vice president's daughter is gay. She's a lesbian. Now, just imagine this. Just imagine this situation. The president is giving his State of the Union message or whatever it was, and he's declaring openly that homosexuals should not be allowed in the army and they should be restricted in this way or that way from marriage and so on. And the vice president is standing right behind him and his daughter is a lesbian and he has to applaud. What is even more fantastic is when this girl told her parents, they simply loved her. They simply supported her. They were surprised, but they did not demand anything from her. They did not try to restrict her in any way. Just think about that. I was just amazed. I was watching that in total amazement, thinking about, as an individual, somebody can be so different in a sense than the way they represent themselves in a political arrangement. Whereas the love for the family became a higher priority than the political platform. And I thought, gee, you know, that's pretty far out. That's amazing. And at the same time, just think about the problems that everybody is facing today because there are so many boxes. How do you stuff anybody into the box? You have to start choosing the boxes, but then you have to start arranging all the boxes into categories. But it doesn't work anymore because there's such a wide variety. And you could have such an insane situation. You'll have totally incompatible people doing things which formerly nobody could even conceive of. I mean, if you would understand it from American point of view, you could have... Anyway, forget it. I'm not going to say it. Just... I conclude this long discussion in a very simple way. The idea of creating structures in spirituality according to the former models is just simply obsolete. We have to accept the individual's responsibility, the individual's right and need to structure themselves as they feel they can and as they feel they want to. Indeed, we have to protect that right. We have to facilitate that right. And all the spirituality that we have, that we share, that we might even give to others, must be in the context of that right. And if we act as guides or mentors to others, Our goal should be to find out what they want, how they feel, how they see themselves, and support that in the context of their own spiritual evolution. So spirituality becomes a practical affair of facilitating other people's growth. Facilitating it, not dictating it. So spiritualists change from preachers, or those who aren't concerned, to facilitators as a service. And because this is so complementary to what we are as people, it will cause our own evolution to blossom. I'll start off with the question that came from St. Petersburg. It said, today I spoke about individual ways of attaining happiness, and then they're asking, how does that relate to statements in Scripture that say that every historical period has its own best method of attaining happiness? Particularly, we speak about chanting as the best way for our age. I would not even wish to comment on that because I don't see the relevance of it in relationship to what I'm saying. I don't believe I've ever stated that there's something wrong with chanting, or chanting is not good for you, or mantras are somehow or another not relevant. I know that the question does not directly ask that, but I think that needs to be said. I mean, after all, I chant myself. However, when and if someone were to wish to demand that this is the one and only methodology, and there is no other, in other words, you just do this and you don't have to do anything else, I would question that in the context of the modern age. I mean, even amongst those who are in groups which have that philosophy, almost, I would say, the vast majority of their time is spent in other activities. And I would also ask what would be the relevance of chanting and not really paying attention by being agitated within by so many other things, or not even being able to connect to the whole point of chanting. So I would say that if one could be supported in one's spiritual evolution, and if there were other methodologies by which that support could really bring one to the point of spiritual understanding, how could that in any way be wrong? For example, deity worship was a methodology in another age, yet the same people use deity worship in this age. And Rupa Goswami spoke about the need of deity for the sake of the advancement of a person. Now, meditation was also a process from a previous age, yet everybody is chanting Gayatri mantras, or when they're doing deity worship, there is a lot of meditation involved. Or fire yajnas are performed for the same reason. So obviously, it does not mean that just because chanting is supposed to be the best way to do something nowadays, that anything else has no value. And I would go so far as to say that it would be in the spirit of those who have discussed such rules and regulations that when it is advantageous for the people who are performing these different spiritual activities to do some variety of spiritual activities, how could it be wrong? And again, I'll repeat that as soon as you try to demand and restrict people into one particular kind of a box, you are missing the point of the requirement of the individuality of each individual, that every person is different and approaches their awareness, their understanding of their consciousness from their own individual and unique point of view. So I think that clarifies that situation. Here's another question. also coming as a kind, I suppose, of bringing back ancient history and trying to understand it in the context of modern times. And the question is basically if the Bhagavad Gita is applicable, because I'm using the words, these instructions are orders and not tools, as I spoke about. I would question the premise of this question. I think that the question does not represent the Bhagavad Gita properly. For after all, Krishna himself told Arjuna, he said, now I've told you everything, you do what you want. In other words, he said that I've given you a very complete picture of things. Now you have to decide what's best to do. Yet the whole point was that Arjuna should fight, which wasn't even an order either. If you think about it, you might think of all the things described in Bhagavad Gita as orders, but in reality, it was all meant to bring Arjuna to the point of clarifying his mind so he would engage in battle. So in Bhagavad Gita, we go through the topics of the eternality of the soul, the connection between the soul and the Supreme. We go through the actions and that are to be performed. We go through knowledge. We go through yoga. We go through even connections to different kinds of mystic practices. And then they go through devotional service. Many topics are discussed. Bhagavad Gita speaks about the yoga practice, about the meditative practices. That's a tool. Bhagavad Gita speaks about knowledge. That's a tool that when one understands what is right and what is wrong, and one acts on it, it burns up all things, reactions, all kinds of reactions. So it seems to me that it makes perfect sense that what Krishna was doing was giving Arjuna a bunch of tools, or explaining what the tools were for self-realization. So therefore, facilitation is something that Krishna does. But the questioner, the original questioner that we're speaking about, has objected by saying that it is an order, because after Arjuna saw the universal form, there was no longer any possibility to deny Krishna's advice. But yet I can answer in the same way that the whole point of that universal form is to get Arjuna to fight. If you examine what was stated in there, Krishna says, I've already killed all these people. The arrangement has already been made. They're all dead. Either you fight and get the credit or not. It's up to you. It's not that Krishna showed Arjuna the universal form and then ordered him to perform yoga. Time out. They're asking for a time out. They're going back to the bench to ask the coach some advice. Replacements are being brought in for the questioner. So me, the referee, has granted them a timeout because the clock was ticking. The point is that this is not the advice of a friend. Krishna himself is talking. Huh? Okay, maybe they're trying to say, Krishna's God and Krishna's telling what to do. My point is the same, that Krishna gave different forms of spiritual activity in Bhagavad Gita. There was yoga, there was meditation, there was karmic yoga, action, there was knowledge, jnana yoga, samkhya yoga, there was bhakti yoga. There were many different things spoken in Bhagavad Gita. So Krishna ultimately said, just surrender to me and get out there and fight, because that's the point. Understand? And now I'm being objected, how can I choose a less processed than pure bhakti, because bhakti is the highest process? And I tell you, go and listen to my lecture where I talk about bhakti. Bhakti means, ultimately, to be able to act in love. That means to be totally in connection with the essence of what you are, and to act out of love. So the idea is to get to that platform of love so that you can express it, that you can act the being and doing. Again, to be that love that you are, that love which is the reflection, the part of the divine, the supreme, and act in that manner. That is bhakti. Okay, moving to another question. If one makes changes and because of that others are suffering, is that proper? And in general, how should one figure out what is right and what is wrong? In other words, if the changes we make create suffering for others around us, should that be taken into consideration? After all, is it right or is it wrong to do it? And how would I decide whether it is right or wrong? Now, that's a very important question. I mean, after all, for example, back to Bhagavad Gita and Arjuna. He's sitting on the chariot and he says, I'm going to make the change of not fighting because I don't feel like doing it. Well, potentially, that would have caused a lot of suffering to all those people on the battlefield who are on Arjuna's side because he was the main warrior. So Arjuna really didn't know what to do. He didn't really have any idea. So therefore, Krishna helped him figure out what was right and wrong by giving him an overview of the whole situation and at giving him some direction to take. It seems to me that this is one of the most difficult things to decide in life. On what basis should I make my choices? Well, that is a very, very difficult thing because there are many, many things you could see, many, many ways to view a situation. Nothing is obvious. Nothing is black and white. Well, first of all, one has to understand what is the circumstance within which I'm going to make my choice. Is this the right time or not? Is the right location or not? Is my motivation correct or not? But I would say, even more important, would be to understand what it is that I'm making a decision about. In other words, to get all the facts, to research, to observe, to try to understand what it is that I'm going to make a choice about. And I'll even bring it back to the Bhagavad Gita, because I've seen by experience, that when one is faced with choices or decisions, more existential kind, that when you get the full picture of what is really before you, there are not that many choices to make, and it becomes obvious what you should do. Therefore, it's very important to examine the possibilities, to understand the circumstances, to research, to just allow yourself to get the full information before making a choice. Those who say, I don't need to do any research, I don't need to figure it out, it's all obvious, it's clear, I'm going to do like this. Or those who say there's no need to do any of this observation or examination because somebody told me it's like this and therefore block off all possibilities, they, I think, are making a mistake. I don't think the mistake is simply to follow something because maybe it's right or wrong in certain situations. I think the mistake is to assume that you understand a situation. Sometimes we assume we understand other people's motives. We assume why people do what they do. But then what happens is all that we see, we fit within our theory of why they are doing what they do. So like the evolutionary theory was first a theory and then they fit all the pieces of evidence to it later on. And when there were pieces of evidence which didn't fit, they just threw them away. Therefore, in spirituality, you can, of course, just accept some philosophy and then fit everything into that later on. Or you can get facility, you can learn as much as you can learn, find the essence, find your own essence, and find your way to what's right. I mean, It's not that one has to believe something. You don't have to believe anything. One can go towards understanding in a variety of ways. And if you find a particular way resonates well with you, and another person finds that another particular way resonates better with them, to tell them or restrict them into what you are doing is pretty violent. It doesn't really bother me when somebody feels what they're doing is the greatest thing, and it's the only thing, and it's the best thing. It doesn't bother me, because it's a manifestation of human nature to think that what you do is great, it's wonderful, it's right. It doesn't even bother me when they walk all over the place and demand by saying that what we are doing is the best. Because after all, religionists have been doing that since the beginning of time, and killing each other on the basis of that too. And it has also been seen that people change their mind. In other words, we really seriously, sincerely, totally accept something as absolutely perfectly wonderful until we don't. In Conversations with God, there's a very interesting way in which things are stated that God will say in the book, it's definitely like this, or maybe not. Now, I know that sounds like double talk, but in reality, it's a very good way to keep the mind open, to always be examining what you are doing. Because when you accept things in a very narrow way, placing yourself in a very narrow format, you tend to do things which are self-destructive and destructive of others, even without knowing it. The path to hell is paved with good intentions. Now, I understand that what I'm saying can agitate people who require connection to something that they feel so fundamentally true that they have to devote their lives to it. I know that what I'm saying is an agitating thing. But if you want to be a fundamentalist, at least you should be a convinced fundamentalist. In other words, you should understand the reasons why you're a fundamentalist. You should be aware of all of the assumptions you are making. You should be in complete consciousness of your choice. Because when you are fully aware, you may want to modify your assumptions somewhat. You may want to modify what you're doing somewhat, because at least you'll be aware of why you're doing what you're doing. So, to get back to the question and relate it to the question, if you understand clearly the situation you are in, the changes you have to make will be obvious. And if you are connected to your being and the love that you are, the choices you make will be based on that love within the context of the situation. And therefore, the decision you make will be usually the best possible one for all concerned. And I hope I have answered that question.